Blog Talk Radio.
Caller, let me help you.
My roommate isn't wearing my clothes. What should I do?
Go to AT&T. They're giving you up to $650 in value to help you switch when you trade in your current smartphone and buy a new one on AT&T Next.
Wow, $650? How does that help with my situation?
$650 in value can help you save up for your own place or a really nice deadbolt. AT&T, mobilizing your world.
Limited time offer. Each line requires eligible port-in, trade-in, purchase, and service. Get minimum of $10 trade-in credit plus prepaid card and amount of device balance or early termination fee, less trade-in. Fees, charges, and restrictions apply. See store for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer, and today we have a wonderful guest, a minister of 25 years and psychologist, Daniel Harrell, who is the author of How to Be Perfect. This is an interesting show. It's going to be a little bit of a reality concept we're going to get into. But Daniel wrote a book and took 19 people with him on a journey through 30 days through the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament. So Daniel Harrell, thank you so much for being with us on Unlimited Realities. Welcome.
Thank you, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. Now, this is a great idea and concept. Is this your brainchild of doing this idea? Was this something that came to you? Or was it
offered to you? It probably came from a lot of corners. I think that, you know, given the popularity of reality television these days, it was inevitable that it would find its way into somebody's pulpit. And as I was, you know, preparing to tackle a book of the Bible in my church that most of us who preach on Sundays work arduously to avoid, I thought that the only way I was going to do it in a way that folks might hang with me would be to, you know, bring some reality element to it. There was a very popular book out last few years called The Year of Living Biblically by A.J. Jacobs, where he followed the Bible as literally as possible for a year, and that was quite popular. And I think his inspiration too was part of what made me jump into this.
And why the book of Leviticus? I know it's a challenging book in the Old Testament, but what made you choose? And I know I'm going off topic in regard to my order of questions for you, but I have to throw this one in there. Why Leviticus?
Well, you know, in some sense, you're like, well, why not? It's in the Bible. But I think the biggest reason is that for those of us who are Christians and in churches and who listen to the words of Jesus week after week, we forget sometimes that Jesus was Jewish, that Jesus was an obedient Jew. And to be an obedient Jew means that you heed the book of Leviticus. Leviticus sits front and center in the Torah. And so much of the language of the New Testament, words like sacrifice and atonement and blood, these kinds of terms all find their origins in Leviticus. So it's pretty essential on the one hand. If you're fully going to understand all that's going on in the New Testament, you need some acquaintance with this sometimes confusing and offending book.
Now tell us a little bit in regard to, you took 19 people from your congregation and you offered them this option of basically living with you for 30 days through the book and the laws and the regulations of Leviticus of the Old Testament. And you also used the power of social media to help move this movement, to, you know, increase your movement here. Talk to me a little bit about how this was received both by your congregation and also social media and Facebook.
Well, you know, the idea of Leviticus, when you read it, you recognize pretty quickly that it's written to a community of people, and its intention is to, like any book of law, intended to guide people in living life rightly. And so the idea behind it is that it instructs us, and instructs people instructed that ancient tribe of Israelites how it is they were to conduct their lives. And so one of the things that's often, well, that is completely missing in Leviticus that's problematic is rationale. You never get the reasons why these particular laws are given aside from, well, God said so. So part of the challenge first was, you know, were we as modern day Christians who follow a Jesus who is Jewish willing to consider what obeying these laws would look like? Are we willing to follow what is taught in our holy book just because God said so? Well, yeah, I mean, we all know the answer to that. The answer is no. But be that as it may, I thought, well, look, if we're going to understand what's at stake here in Leviticus, really the only way we can understand it is to live it out, because simply just to study it and try to understand it, it wasn't written for that purpose. So I thought, let's try to do it. So I challenged a group I challenged the whole congregation to join me in this quest, and you know, everybody was resistant. Nobody wanted to do this. For many Christians, you know, Leviticus is archaic. It's outmoded. It's obsolete. Mm-hmm. It's no longer to be bothered with. I joke that it's where, you know, read through the Bible in a year, plans go to die. So to follow it is very tedious and problematic. But nevertheless, I managed to coerce a few people with some pastoral guilt to step up to the challenge. Got 19 people to join me. And they did a great job. I'll talk more about them individually in a bit. But as far as the social media part went, one of the things that's very clear about this part of the Old Testament, this nation of people that God calls out for this particular purpose, is that their lives were to be lives seen by the world. They were to be an example of what faithfulness looked like. And so we figured, well, if we're going to be observed, if we're going to be public in doing this, I wanted to go beyond just our local congregation. I wanted to be able to be observed by the world. And, of course, we live in an age where that's easy. So we
Right.
had everybody, you know, get an account on Facebook, and we, you know, put together a group and posted videos and blogs and comments regarding our experience, and had people join and check in from literally all over the world.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, how did you determine which laws you'd follow and which ones you didn't?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that really is the rub when it comes to a book like Leviticus. It's interesting that in the New Testament, when Jesus talks about the two greatest commandments that sum up all the law and the prophet, one is love God, the other is love your neighbor. And love your neighbor is only found in the entire Old Testament in the book of Leviticus. So you can't just write off Leviticus as if it, you know, is not important anymore, because the second greatest commandment, according to Jesus, comes from there. At the same time, love your neighbor as yourself in Leviticus shows up right beside a commandment that says, don't sow your field with two different kinds of seed. And you're like, all right, so on what basis is, you know, love your neighbor to be obeyed, but not, you know, don't put, you know, pansies with parsley in your garden.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the rub, because Leviticus gives you no help as to, well, this one's important, but this one's not. And so the first challenge was, you know, the challenge of interpretation. And so what we did was we sort of laid before the participants the opportunity to sort of figure out what was the grid they were going to put Leviticus through. And people tried different things. For instance, you know, some people said, all right, whatever's in Leviticus that the New Testament and Jesus expressly affirms, I'm going to follow that. Others said, well, hey, whatever's in Leviticus that the New Testament and Jesus doesn't expressly reject, I'm going to follow that. For instance, the New Testament, Jesus makes the point that all foods are now clean, so the kosher laws of Leviticus 11 could be avoided according to that grid. Other people decided to use, you know, scholarly commentaries and some help from academics. Others decided, one woman decided to use a children's interpretation of Leviticus. Others tried to use modern Jewish and rabbinic understandings of Leviticus. Others just kind of divided up, you know, a commandment a day, and tried to do one a day and see how that went. So folks tried a variety of paths.
Ah, okay, all right. So it was very individual, and there was no real right or wrong. It was just be, you know, honor the book as closely as you can, kind of?
Well, I mean, you know, in some sense it was an experiment. And, I mean, of course, as a pastor, there's something sad about that, you know, trying to get your congregation to, you know, obey the Bible for a month. and people to push back on that. But that aside, you know, there was an experimental side to it. There was a sense in which, all right, you know, here's a part of the Bible that we routinely ignore and are unfamiliar with. So let's each try it our own way as best we can and see what happens. I mean, it was very open-ended. At the same time, we were also very cognizant that the thing was to be a collective experience. And so as we posted on Facebook, we kept in touch with one another. We met regularly and shared our experiences. And a couple of the folks, you know, grouped up together and did the month together so that there was a sense of communal participation in it.
Now, you talk individually about some of the participants, and you get into, you know, some of the things that they did in regard to altering the laws for modern day. How can you explain how you and some of the others did modernize some of the laws, like get into some of the individual tweaking that they did?
Sure. I mean, first, the thing that was so wonderful about this group was the variety of people who were represented. I mean, we had, you know, college professors and scientists, an investment banker, an opera singer, lawyer. We had, you know, a stay-at-home mom. We had a couple of students. I mean, it ran the whole gamut. It was really beautiful to have that broad range of participation. And folks from, you know, a number of cultures, you know, a woman from Indonesia, you know, another woman from India, a guy from Albania. So we had those kind of cultural grids as well. And so you got some great interpretations. The guy who was Northern Irish, who was in Boston from Northern Ireland, actually lived on a cattle farm and happened to be at his family's home during one week of that month. And he decided to try the Levitical commandment to have your sins atoned for by laying a hand on a head of cattle, literally. So he went into his family's cattle barn, where, you know, a number of head of cattle were, and decided to try to lay his hand on the head of one of them. Of course, the cattle were extremely uncooperative, and it's sort of a funny video he made about trying to chase these cattle around to get them to let him touch them. He also sort of took literally the commandment not to blend fabrics, and this was a winter month, and he chose to wear linen the entire month and made the point that, you know, it'd be tough usually to obey Leviticus in the winter. But others tried to make more of a modern translation. For instance, there's a commandment in Leviticus about something called gleaning. Gleaning was a practice where when you were harvesting your field, if grain dropped to the ground, you were to leave it so that the poor and needy could then come through your field and collect that grain for themselves. And the significance of that was not only were the poor and the needy and the alien fed, but they also were given the dignity of work. And so it was just a really beautiful practice that Leviticus encouraged. And so what a couple of folks did, one person decided to take that command to heart and only purchase crops that were fair trade for the month. And so there was a real desire to support small farmers. But another woman took all of her spare change for the month and collected it, and then at the end of the month gave it to a homeless person near her building. So things like that, where people tried to make that translation from the original Levitical intent to a modern interpretation of it.
Okay, all right. And you, how did the women in this experiment respond to the outdated attitude toward the females represented in Leviticus?
Yeah, it's tough because, I mean, you look at all ancient Near Eastern cultures, and it's hard to find, you know,
right,
one that doesn't relegate women to second-class status. And, you know, so there is this prohibition in Leviticus that, you know, when you're going through your monthly period, you're not allowed to be part of the community. You have to separate yourself out from communal gatherings. And so these, you know, number of women decided to do that. And so as we would gather for our dinners weekly, you know, some of them would sit over to the side and, you know, say, well, folks, you know, here's where we are. And, you know, to try to understand that is to recognize that there it had something. I mean, you never get the explanation completely, but it had something to do with blood. And, you know, blood is so important to Leviticus and of course, so important to the theology of the New Testament. You get a glimpse of this importance throughout. Not only is it women during their menstrual period, but also, you know, any kind of blood that ever was shed, whether it's, you know, in cooking or cleaning or, you know, injury, you know, blood was just never to be touched, because Leviticus teaches that life is the blood and it's sacred and to be honored. And so somehow that was wrapped up in that.
Okay.
At the same time, it's interesting when you compare sort of the ancient Israelite culture to other Canaanite cultures of the period. They were actually quite progressive when it came to women. For instance, in Israelite society, there were clear pathways of justice for women who were abused or treated unfairly that would not have been available to women in other cultures. And so that was something that Leviticus teaches that, again, if you're living in that culture in that period, would have been surprising, because you wouldn't have expected that for women given how they were generally treated. Similarly, there's a tax that Leviticus imposes on people, and the tax is greater on men than it is on women. And what is significant about that, I mean, you could read that as, okay, women are worth less. But there's another way to read it, that women are less able to come up with that money that the tax required for the worship of the tabernacle. And so they get a discount because we recognize that in that society it was harder for women to produce that. So in some sense, it doesn't feel progressive to us in, you know, the 21st century, but in that context, it was quite ahead of the game.
And it's interesting, because as I'm hearing, you know, you talk about women having to sit on the outside of community events during their monthly cycle. The the Indians also have a belief in that, in regard to
yes.
women outside of like sweat lodges or any sacred ceremony. So it's interesting how cultures from different countries, you know, thousands of years have carried this tradition throughout, because of, you know, what is assumed a sacred flow of blood. And, you know, you mm-hmm. really get into a lot in regard to the women and how they found their way back into the community because of how they were treated, and what you were saying in regard to how advanced they actually were, because they really honored the protectiveness of the woman. I really appreciated that aspect in the book. Now, what was the philosophy about thinking bad thoughts versus committing bad deeds? You got into a great part in the book with this.
It's interesting. There's, you know, Leviticus talks a lot about holiness, and our sort of standard stock definition of holiness has something to do with being set apart, with being, what we use the language of sacred. And, you know, in some sense, going back to women separating themselves out once a month, there was something about that that's sort of holy. There's a sacredness, a set apartness to that, even though it didn't always feel like that. So this idea of holiness was very important in Leviticus. However, as you pushed a little deeper into our experience, and as we studied this and experienced it, we recognized that more than being set apart, holiness is really about devotion. It has to do with what you're set apart for, that there is an expression of commitment that's really important. So when we read that God says, "You be holy because I'm holy," what effectively we're reading is God saying, "You be as committed to me as I am to you." There's this relational language. Well, as far as holiness is concerned, there's this other aspect that Leviticus describes that contributes to holiness, and that is this language of purity. And it is this purity language that sort of feeds holiness, and purity has to do with motive and with intent. And it seems that this kind of commitment that God is calling his people to is one that is not simply one of going through the motions, but one that is of the heart, one that is of genuine intent. And so there's this entire, two whole chapters in Leviticus are devoted to purity laws, which primarily have to do with skin infection. I mean, Leviticus is very concerned for the body, and you know, holiness is very embodied. And so all that is surrounding and has to do with skin infection in these two chapters, which just seems absolutely insane when we read it in our own sanitized, skin-obsessed culture, the purpose of it seems to be a means of trying to emphasize for folks what it means to have purity of heart, that somehow our bodies became kind of object lessons of our souls. And so all that to say, to your question, motive mattered, and Leviticus makes a big deal of it.
Okay. And so in regard to, you know, thinking bad thoughts, did they, you know, was that something that, because you get into a little bit, you get into a lot in regard to, like, you know, premeditated crimes were just, like, not accepted. And then, you know, there was seemed to be more compassion for those who were kind of struggling within their thoughts. Is that right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you have any familiarity with Leviticus, you probably have some familiarity with the whole animal sacrificial system, which, you know, of course, when you read it, just seems unbelievably barbaric. You know, every time a sin was committed, an animal had to be killed, and there's, again, all this blood and such. But what you're struck by as you, again, read of all of this animal sacrifice is that it only covered those sins that were committed unintentionally, the stuff you did by mistake and by accident. You know, if you did anything willfully or premeditatively, none of that sacrificial system worked. And so suddenly there's this realization, I think for all of us, just a stark realization that Leviticus and, you know, God's concern for, you know, premeditated sin is incredibly severe. And we see that mirrored in our own justice system. You know, the penalty for premeditated murder is much different than that for, you know, second-degree murder or manslaughter,
right,
even though all of it resulted in death. And that's exactly what we see in Leviticus, that if you do something wrong and didn't mean to do it, then, all right, there's a means whereby you can be restored to the community. It's interesting, we asked some of our Jewish friends, we're like, okay, so, you know, obviously, in amongst Jewish communities, there are people who would do things on purpose, do wrong things on purpose. How is that handled in modern-day Judaism? And this one Jewish guy who was sort of serving as a consultant said, no, we don't do anything on purpose, anything wrong on purpose. It's all unintentional. And we just all, you know, howled when he said that because, yeah, no, seriously, we, you know, none of us mean to do anything we do. It was really funny. So, you know, it's just one of these things that, I mean, for Christians, you know, that really brings the whole sacrifice of Jesus to the front, you know, because here you finally have, you know, God himself giving himself for the sake of our premeditated wrongs. But, you know, in Leviticus, that just wasn't available.
Right. And you also, the word scapegoat comes from Leviticus.
Yeah.
How relevant was that?
Well, once a year on this thing called Day of Atonement or Yom Kippur, which remains the most holy day most holy day amongst Jews, there would be two goats. One goat would be sacrificed for the impurity of the temple or the impurity of the tabernacle, the worship place. I mean, there was this understanding, this idea that God resided in this tent that followed the Israelites across the desert from Egypt to the Promised Land. And any sin against God, you know, caused impurities to this tabernacle, and so it needed to be cleansed, and this goat did that. And then secondly, there would be the scapegoat, where you would take symbolically the unconfessed sins of all the people, the unatoned for sins of the people, lay it on that goat, and then chase that goat out into the wilderness. Later, Judaism would actually chase the goat off a cliff to make sure it died, because the last thing anybody wanted was the goat finding its way back into the camp.
So this
idea of scapegoat was, you know, this goat took our blame. And again, in Christian theology, you have Jesus sort of serving as this ultimate scapegoat, that he takes our blame, he takes our sin, you know, on himself. But we still use the language of scapegoat, that somebody has to take the blame, has to take the fall, you know. And that's, we were joking about how we were going to practice scapegoatism, you know, in the during the month, and somebody's like, why don't we get a farmer, why don't we rent a goat? And we're like, no way a farmer's going to let us, you know, chase one of his prized goats out into traffic and get killed. And, well, why don't we have somebody dress up like a goat? And we're like, well, you think somebody actually wants to play that part? So it was it was just interesting to wrestle with, you know, all that sense of blame that is all wrapped up in the idea of scapegoat.
And also the idea of such symbolism used throughout Leviticus, you know, in regard to ritual and practice and kind of validating the laws and the regulations. It was amazing to really come into tune in reading it, you know, how much they really used symbolism, like the goat, you know, and the blood. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything represents something to them, you know, in that.
And that's still the case, you know, in religious ritual. I mean, well, not even just religious rituals. We all, as human beings, are very much ritual people. And so, you know, whatever that looks like in our lives, rituals and symbols are very powerful to us. And so, you know, Leviticus just uses those to, you know, to its own advantage.
Yeah, it definitely was more of a raw symbolism, though, than what we have today, that's for sure.
It's interesting. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, in some sense, that is the case. But, you know, when you think of for instance, just a trip to the movies, and, you know, so much of what gets depicted, you know, in the movies, say, just with violence and blood, and why we would never imagine experiencing that in reality, we still see this on a screen, and it evokes a very strong visceral reaction, whether we, you know, cheer for the justice that occurs or whatever. And so, in some sense, that graphicness that we still experience as modern-day people is still very powerful and important to us, even though it's not, you know, literally blood as much anymore.
Right. Now, what were some of the most outrageous guidelines that were adhered to through the 19 people that went through this experiment?
You know, one of the things that it was really interesting to us is that when you read Leviticus, you would go, okay, this is just insane. But when you started to do it, you realized, wait a minute, there really is a purpose here. Take the sacrificial system. I mean, you know, the idea that you would take your prized cow and kill it for some, you know, mistake you made, that just seems outrageous. Why would you ever do that? But then as you read Leviticus, you find that, well, it wasn't just this wholesale butchering for, you know, for no reason. The meat that was killed was most often cooked and used to feed the community. And so, yes, you had to make a sacrifice of your, you know, prized livestock for the wrong you did, but there was a redemption in that sacrifice, and that the food was used to feed others. And so, you know, you're sort of like struck with, wow, you know, what you thought was brutal and barbaric turned out to, you know, kind of serve a greater purpose. And I think we were all, you know, struck by that kind of thing. There's, you know, we mentioned the whole prohibitions against skin infection. And so people who had eczema and blemishes, you know, found that there was just this outrageous requirement, you know, to get back into the community, you know, involving, you know, hyssop and cedar and shaving. I mean, it goes on and on and on, the kind of things you have to do to get back into the community if you have a skin infection. But then we were struck with, wait a minute. Look at the stuff I already do in American culture when I get a zit. I put on cream, I take pills, I avoid other people. All the things that we're such a skin-obsessed culture. We're not that unlike Leviticus. And, you know, those things we became aware with, you know, we don't use hyssop plant and, you know, cedar and red yarn anymore, but you go into any Sephora skincare center and there's 50 products, you know, for your skin that you would use that's not unlike the 50 things that Leviticus required you to do if you had a skin infection. Same thing with mold and mildew in your house. You know, there's a commandment that if you have mold and mildew in your house, you're to burn it down, you know, because it is an affliction on the house. Well, you know, nobody burned down their house because of mold and mildew, but, you know, we in some cases will do the equivalent. You know, we'll, you know, scour and scrub and, you know, spend all kinds of money to try. And in some cases where the mold is particularly bad, we'll tear out walls and things that have to happen. And so there's this recognition, you know, I think that there was more commonality in Leviticus than we thought was there. But we wouldn't have known it had we not lived it out. You know, just reading it, you go, that's barbaric. But then you do it, you go, oh, maybe it's not as barbaric as we thought.
Right, right. And you were talking about some of the participants, and you had the one gentleman who wore 100% linen, and you had another one who offered a burnt grain on his kitchen stove and smoked out the entire complex.
and then some of the funny ones were some of the simple ones. We had one guy who, a lot of the guys grew beards because there's this one prohibition in Leviticus against shaving. And the guy who was the investment banker, you know, grew the beard. And, of course, he, you know, worked in a firm where everybody was, you know, clean shaven and, you know, really fit that part. And he, you know, came in looking like, you know, Jeremiah Johnson or somebody out of the – and it was just – it was really something because his – you know, colleagues and his clients were, you know, just appalled, and you know, he had to be called into the conference office, and you know, Paul, when are you going to shave this beard? He's like, well, I got to wear it for a month for these reasons, and it was just, you know, we really gave him props for sticking with it and explaining
really?
To his, you know, partners why he stuck with it, but he struggled with that, you know, having to explain that, and you know, people thinking he was crazy. He's like, you know, I kind of get what it must have been like to be an ancient Israelite and have to bear the scorn of, you know, other nations that looked at us in these commandments.
And it was also, I mean, the book of Leviticus is like, you know, it's pretty heavy against homosexuality, and then you know, did you have anybody who had tattoos? I mean, there was a whole lot of, you know, the skin diseases like you were talking about, and, you know, the haircuts and the tattoos and the homosexuality and the Sabbath keeping, the animal sacrifice. I mean, all of these are something, you know, that you can look at. But today in the 21st century, if you had anybody under 30, you know, there's a 50% chance they might have a tattoo. So
it's funny.
Brought in at all? Or?
Yeah, oh, sure. I mean, you know, it's funny. There's a tattoo parlor here in Minneapolis where I now live that's called Leviticus 18:22, which is the prohibition against tattoos. It's pretty funny. We can say that nobody actually got a tattoo during the month, though a couple people already had them. And, you know, we're just sort of, you know, had to live with it, I guess, for that month. The homosexuality issue, of course, was a big one. And for many people, if they don't know anything else about Leviticus, know about that prohibition because it's been used as, you know, so vehemently against you know, the gay community from many Christians, unfortunately. And but it was interesting in the context of that conversation because the prohibition against homosexuality appears in a chapter that deals with sexual ethics as a whole. And we had a number of folks on Facebook, gay and straight, who commented on our thoughts in this regard in surprising ways. You know, a couple of people who are gay wrote that, you know, they actually thought that the prohibition, you know, made some sense given the tendency that they observed amongst their friends toward promiscuity and other things. And whereas other folks were, you know, vehemently opposed to that particular prohibition. And, you know, it raised all the issues that are current, you know, in our own culture regarding homosexuality, certainly within churches. But I think for us what was helpful, as is always the case, was to see it in the context and to recognize, if nothing else, that, again, the body matters to God. And so sexual ethics, just like hygiene, just like eating, all of these things that are just part and parcel of our daily life mattered. And so it really forced us to, I think, take a deeper look at sexuality in ways that, you know, perhaps we wouldn't have otherwise done. As for the Sabbath, I think, again, a practice that, you know, was one of the Ten Commandments that, you know, folks who follow the Bible are, you know, encouraged to heed. And all of us know how poorly we've done that, unless you're an Orthodox Jew and have a good, you know, sort of setup for following that. But we were struck that the Sabbath was by far the most controversial part of our month, as far as people who were weighing in on Facebook from around the world, as we were exploring Sabbath and imagining how we might practice that. More than any other topic, we had people comment on that. Many ferociously, a number of people ferociously. Yeah, so surprising. You know that, you know, we weren't doing it right, or we weren't doing it on the right day, or with the right spirit. I mean, we called these folks our Facebook Pharisees. I mean, they really were just hounding us about how we were practicing Sabbath. And on the one hand, we were really surprised. But then again, right, you go back and you read the New Testament, and you see 80% of the heat that Jesus catches from the religious leaders of his day is about the Sabbath. I mean, the Sabbath really mattered. And as we explored that, we recognized that, you know, the reason that the Sabbath mattered so much and that working on the Sabbath was such an issue is because, you know, nobody works on the Sabbath but God. Because obviously if God doesn't work on the Sabbath, then, you know, the world falls apart. So to work on the Sabbath was, in effect, to equate yourself with God. And this is why, of course, the Pharisees were so mad at Jesus. Of course, Jesus responds, well, I'm Son of God, so I can't work on the Sabbath. But, you know, for us, that whole Sabbath piece just instigated a lot of heat amongst the Facebook folks.
Huh. That's a really a great perception, because that's a perception I really never considered in regard to the Sabbath and working on it. I just figured, well, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't necessarily to compare, but I just figured, well, it's the law that they go by, and it's what, you know, it's to honor God and not to work. I never looked at it as you would be comparing yourself to God, because God's working and you don't work on that day. That's an interesting perspective there. What were some of the most surprising and profound lessons that you found among the 19 who did this? Was it more individual? Was it more community-based? Was it awakenings and awarenesses that they you know, each went through? Or was it the most profound thing, something that was more global or more altogether as a community?
I think on the... there was a little bit of all of that. I think on the global side, the thing that folks walked away with most was just an awareness that even those who professed the strongest faith in God and in Jesus nevertheless found obedience to be you know, difficult and hard and challenging. It was interesting, you know, one of the conversations or amongst the conversations that many of us had was with some Orthodox Jewish communities where, you know, they sort of laughed at us a little bit. One rabbi's like, what, you're going to do this for a month? What's a month? You know, you want to learn it, you do it for your life. And there was something about that kind of lifelong devotion there that you would cross a threshold and kind of move from obedience as this burden to one of truly joy. And I think for some of us, we, you know, started to taste that. It made me wish that we'd made the project longer to kind of get there, because I think for most of us, after the month was up, it was kind of easy to revert back to our sort of pre-Levitical ways. Nevertheless, I think on the other side, there were for a number of individuals some real glimpses of glory and grace. I know one of the things that struck many of us was the fact that Leviticus, you know, cares about what you eat, what you wear, how you treat your skin. It cares about sex. It cares about relationships. It cares about your work. It cares about justice. The fact that it runs the entire gamut from the mundane to the sublime really underscored for many of us that everything matters, that, you know, that God cares about every detail of life. You know, in the New Testament, one of the popular verses is, you know, that even the hairs on our head are numbered, which sometimes we take as a very foreboding kind of thing. But in fact, it's a very tender, caring thing. That there's not any detail of our lives that escapes God's notice. And that was, I think, really significant for a lot of us. I know for me, coming on the other side of that, during those days when you feel like, you know, you're just stuck in the tedium and the drudgery and nothing's happening, you feel like it's a wasted day, I go back and remember Leviticus and am reminded that there's no such thing as a wasted day, you know, that everything counts, you know, in the context of, you know, the economy of God, if you will.
And that brings me right to my next question. How can these lessons in Leviticus, it obviously altered the perceptions of the 19 and yourself in doing this for 30 days, but how can Leviticus and the lessons that were worked through for these 30 days help the average person or someone who is spiritual, someone who isn't spiritual? Can they be something that we can all get a little bit of a seedling of insight and awareness from?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a great question because, I mean, again, to open up the Bible and read it is, you know, hard enough for some people. To open up the Bible and read Leviticus is just downright impossible because, I mean, you know, first chapter, you're just like, what in the world are these guys talking about? And you've got to be kidding me. So it is a challenge. And, you know, I think that if I was going to encourage anyone to try anything, it would be, well, you know, pick a few of these things, give it a shot and see what, like one of the things that I did, and it's just a little thing, but Leviticus commands that you rise in the presence of the elderly.
Okay.
And, you know, so for the month, whenever a person who's aged with white hair was in my presence, I stood up. Now, I mentioned in the book one day this got me in trouble because I was at an afternoon symphony concert and most everybody there was retired. And I stood up, and the lady behind me was like, "Will you sit down?" You know, so, you know. But in other instances, you know, we live in a culture where, you know, the old are treated so poorly, unlike,
right,
you know, other cultures. They're sort of pushed off to the side and institutionalized. And, you know, we honor the young, you know, in our society.
Right.
And here, you know, you've got this emphasis on respect of the aged and all that living a full life represents, and to stand and honor that. Wow, whether you're spiritual or not, there's something significant, you know, in that.
That is huge.
And that's huge. Yeah, you know, and something just like just doing that, if you were to think, you know, I'm going to stand and respect you, that's a big thing.
It is. That's right. And that's something that you can do in, you know, every day. And in Florida, you can do it every minute of every day.
Yeah, you'll never sit down in Florida. Yeah, you're staying.
I'd be walking and standing all day long.
That's right.
Lots of respect going on around here, yes. But it's true.
Well, yeah,
it's
interesting.
I mean,
where, yeah, no, I, you know, I'm in a church currently that has a much larger contingent of older people than my previous church had, the church that actually did the Leviticus project. And, you know, they're very concerned that, you know, we get younger people in the church. And I know part of that concern has to do with, you know, you want a church to continue and you want that new life that younger folks bring. But I keep trying to remind them that, you know, to also be a church that honors the old is not a bad thing, because we're all going to be there. And I think a lot of folks, as we age, as we, you know, get toward that day when perhaps we, you know is going to be upon us, there's a lot of fear because who's going to take care of us? And, you know, to live in a culture where that worry is gone would be pretty significant.
And, you know, it goes to say also, granted, we're a culture and a country who really puts way too much emphasis upon the young and not enough respect and admiration for the wisdom of the elderly. But we also have, you know, as we go through our days, we have more of an appreciation for the divine and the essence, whether it's in our awareness or in our chronological age that kind of gives us that, you know, 2x4 upside the head that says, hey, you know, your days are limited, you better get in touch with God. Or, you know, you actually are going through life and you want to get in touch with God. But, you know, notoriously the young are brought to the church either through their own calling or, you know, basically through their own family. So to bring the young in, it's almost as if you don't want to bring them in dragging, kicking, and screaming because that's kind of defeats the purpose, you know. And, and the elderly are there by choice. They're there, you know, out of something that motivated them to get there. So the intention is different. And
it takes you a lifetime to get to a place where you, you know, recognize that there's something more to this world than I, you know, understood as a young person.
Exactly. And there's also that piece where, you know, in regard to the experiment itself, you know, you've helped so many people kind of open up their eyes in looking at life through more of an appreciation and a gratitude, whether it's in our 21st century modern ways or basically just to simplify life and get back to basics. But it was really a genius move for you in regard to kind of awakening minds to a different perspective and way of living. Now, your comments, you were saying you got these from all over the world when you were on Facebook and you had all these comments coming in. Do you believe that there's going to be an impact that has long-range, you know, benefits from this? Do you feel like there's something that at least your 19 people took from this that they're going to implement more in their day-to-day life from this experience?
Well, you always hope so. I mean, I think one of the things that struck us is, you know, or that we know, we live in a culture that draws a pretty strict divide between the sacred, you know, and the secular. And you read through Leviticus, and sort of what you expect is, you know, more of this emphasis on, you know, kind of the sacred and the ethereal and, you know, those things that should belong in church. And what you're struck with instead is everything that's considered sacred is all the stuff in our day and age we would think of as secular. Again, you know, how I eat, what I wear, how I clean my house. And I think it's really the fault of those of us who are religious people that we've sort of, you know, decided we want to, whether it's professionalize or compartmentalize or take control of those things that are sacred, that we've kind of pulled it out of those ordinary aspects of life where, you know, Leviticus really seeks to influence. And again, I think for all of us, there was this recognition that if we're serious about spirituality, if we're serious about the greater meanings of life, it can't be something that simply impacts us as we walk through the woods or read an inspirational book. It has to affect us as we work. It has to affect us in our families and raising kids. It has to affect us as we do the laundry. And Leviticus has something to say about all of that.
And I really like that because I do believe that when we step into that mode of trying to live our lives spiritually, it doesn't just come 1 hour a week on Sunday at church. It's every aspect of your life. It's how you raise your kids. It's how you drive. It's how you interact in a grocery store. It's niceness versus nastiness. It's basically what's the essence coming from you, you know. And I really liked your comment here in regard to religious people's point, because I would think that the religious views are based more in dogma and that type of thinking, versus the spiritual base people are living life more with the intent to live spiritually on every aspect. Do you find that there's a difference there?
Well, I mean, this is where, you know, something like Leviticus gets a bad rap, because it does read like a list of do's and don'ts. You know, it is a bunch of laws. And when people talk about dogma, when they talk about, you know, religious insensitivity or judgmentalism or legalism, you know, it always comes with those kinds of passages of scripture in mind. But again, on the other hand, it's one thing to be opposed to do's and don'ts that seem, you know, prohibitive. But it's another thing when you see Leviticus as a set of, as a path, or as a template for, you know, living a life devoted to God. It really isn't intended so much to squelch life as much as it is to enhance life. I mean, it's a great analogy is in parenting. I mean, sort of the way Leviticus happens is, you can imagine that, you know, ancient Israelites were going about living their lives, and they, you know, do something wrong, like they stick their fingers in the light socket, and you have to make a law: don't do that, because if you do that, it's going to be bad. But no parent does that because they're trying to take all the fun out of a kid's life. You do it for that kid's well-being. You do it because you love that child. And, and you know, so much about Leviticus is that. It's like, don't do that, not because I don't want you to have any fun, but because I want you to stay alive, you know, and to live enjoy. And you know, I think that it's easy to just, you know, put a blanket statement on those sort of law parts of the Bible and kind of go, well, those are just legalistic. And they can certainly be used in that way. But there's another side, too, that if you see them from an intent to love, they look much different.
And for you personally, what did you find was the most outrageous law of Leviticus?
Well, the most outrageous law, you know, I guess the one that I just struggled with, you know, understanding as to, you know, why in the world it would be in the Bible, has to do with all of these things about mixing, whether it's mixing seeds, mixing fabrics, mixing soils. I mean, there's all of this concern about mixing stuff up. Now, I know that in ancient Israel that there's this idea that a concern with the other cultures, that they would corrupt Israel and that these pagan practices would find their way into Israel. And so, again, this purity issue was very important. But, you know, there's almost just this kind of separatist obsession that Leviticus seems to teach, that you begin to kind of worry and go, well, wait a minute. Isn't God the God of all people? And so, you know, as we were trying to practice keeping things separate, you're always struck with, you know, why in the world would, and again, Leviticus doesn't offer you any, you know, rationale, you know, for doing that. There's also a couple of places where, you know, for instance, when you disobey the Sabbath, you're supposed to be stoned, and that's pretty outrageous, and needless to say, we didn't practice that one. Or if we did, we did it with very little rocks, so as not to hurt anybody.
Did you really? Did you really throw pebbles?
Well, you know, I have to say that actually comes from A.J. Jacobs' book. There's this hilarious point where he's trying to find an adulterer to stone, and he finally runs across one in Central Park, and he takes a handful of pebbles and starts chucking them at the guy, and of course he just throws them back, and they get into a big fight. It's a pretty funny chapter.
Oh, that's great. Well, I want to make sure everybody can find you. So your website is www.danielharrell.com, DanielHarrell. And Daniel, you've been a wonderful guest. What would you like to share with us before we close up the show here in regard to our listening audience?
Yeah, I would say definitely if you would like to read or download the book, and not to be afraid of it because it's about Leviticus. If you're open to sort of hearing a different angle of how a group of people wrestled with something that we tend to avoid, it was a wonderful experience, and one that, you know, even if you never choose to practice it yourself, you can enjoy vicariously through a group of folks who did. I think we all walked away from it with a genuine sense that, you know, even those arcane aspects, you know, of the Bible can be wonderfully rich. And I think we experienced that.
And it's a great it really is a genius idea to the ability to actually get 19 more people to do this for 30 days, I think is absolutely phenomenal. You must have a very loyal congregational following.
Like I said, a little pastoral guilt helped too. What, you don't want to obey the Bible for a month? I mean, you know, I was able to twist a couple of arms.
Oh, Daniel,
that.
You didn't do that, did you?
Just in a couple of places, absolutely. They teach us that in seminary.
it's the good Christian guilt, isn't it? It's
yes. But, well, there, you know, there are sometimes a little guilt can, you know, sometimes we need to feel it maybe more than we do. And it was nice on the end that, you know, folks, I think even that were guilted into it thought it was a good experience.
Oh, it sounds like they all really learned a lot from it, and I really love the part of how they morphed it to make it work for the 21st century. I thought that some of those ideas were really ingenious. So
yeah, one woman, you know, she built a tabernacle in her apartment and kind of lived near it the whole time. And, you know, after the experiment was over, she left up the tabernacle in her apartment and, you know, commented about how, you know, it was just great having God around all the time. So.
Oh, isn't that nice? Isn't that nice?
Yeah,
you know, it's
cool.
That little touch of that little seedling, that little planting of just a different perspective, a different way to look at things and appreciate the simplicity, you know? And I'm sure that some of the ways weren't as simple, but it does bring you back to your core, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, I think that, again, everybody, because it's not a book that often gets read, you know, I think coming up against some of the things Leviticus taught, folks were pleasantly, you know, surprised that was actually, you know, in the Bible, and found that a lot of the stuff that, you know, was already a part of their lives, or, you know, these normal parts of their lives were being affirmed in ways that they hadn't expected. So it wasn't all just, you know, wow, I've got to obey this. So there was a lot of, huh, how about that? God cares about my laundry, and I didn't even know it.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, Daniel,
yeah,
thank
good.
You so much for being
You're
on
so
Unlimited
welcome.
Realities. It's been wonderful listening to your story, and I really find you an inspiring pastor, so I'm sure your congregation is learning quite a lot from you, and that's a great contribution that you're offering everybody. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you very much, Lisa. I appreciate you having me on.
You're welcome. Have a wonderfully blessed day. Thank you so much for joining us. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. God bless you. Have a wonderful week. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
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 Bye.
Omega whats, threes, sixes, nines. It can be really confusing. At GNC, we get it, and we're here to help. It's all about DHA and EPA, the good stuff. And GNC fish oil has more of it than any other brand. That's why it's America's number one brand of high-potency fish oil. Still got questions? Stop in and talk with your local GNC expert. Just ask. We make it simple. See store for details.
Adding the choice of a crispy chicken BLT to Wendy's 4-for-4 is the biggest thing since rappers trying to sing.
I got me out and I sound like a robot.
But do you like the sound of this? Wendy's 4-for-4 now comes with a choice of a junior bacon cheeseburger or a crispy chicken BLT.
From Detroit to Macon, I keep it crisp like bacon.
Both are topped with crispy applewood smoked bacon and come with 4 nuggets, fries, and a Coke for just $4.
Oh, yeah.
At participating Wendy's for a limited time, meal includes small fries and a drink. Not valid in Alaska and Hawaii.